This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, Thomas Eric Duncan, the first person diagnosed with Ebola in the U.S., passed away. With the first statewide death and thousands dead in West Africa, the FDA has been working to quickly review experimental treatments for the deadly disease. But are these experimental drugs really the key to ending this epidemic? Or should we be investing in other tools that help health workers identify the disease faster? Joining me to discuss strategies for containing and ending the ongoing Ebola outbreak is Laurie Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Good to see you again, Laurie.
Hi, Ira.
Is finding a cure for Ebola the key to ending this outbreak?
No, because we won't have one in any time frame that's reasonable to look at. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any direct cure sitting out there waiting for instantaneous discovery. What we have is a set of monoclonal antibodies and other biologicals, very difficult to make, must be kept refrigerated, require enormous care to keeping them sterile and so on, all of which makes it pretty difficult to imagine mass production and implementation in the tropics.
Mm-hmm. You feel that finding a rapid diagnostic test for Ebola is as important or perhaps more important than finding a cure. A rapid, what is that?
In this time frame, mm-hmm. as in, according to the Centers for Disease Control, if we don't get this thing under control in the next few weeks, mm-hmm. we'll be looking at up to 1.4 million cases by February 1st. So you have to be thinking, what technologically is possible in this time frame? You're not going to have a vaccine in this time frame, you're not going to have a cure, and you're not going to have a much improved treatment modality. So what do you have? The situation right now that affects the politics here in the United States around the Ebola question, do you shut airports? Do you bar Africans from coming into America, as some politicians have called for? And actually getting the epidemic under control on the ground is all about knowing who's infected before they're so sick that they're highly contagious, they're dying, and they require isolation care. If you can separate the infected from the uninfected, you can begin to stop the transmission.
Instead of waiting that 10-day period, we need something that works in a matter of minutes with a blood sample.
Exactly. A pinprick sample, something like what diabetics do every day to measure their glucose level. A little pinprick and down in a little droplet of blood on a plate, and it tells you an answer. It changes color or it luminesces. Mm. And there are quite a number of things in the pipeline right now, and a lot of acceleration. Venture capitalists are stepping forward. Some major philanthropic players are stepping forward, and the FDA has agreed to really, like, beyond belief, fast track this.
Yeah.
Because I think everybody realizes this is the only missing tool in the toolkit that can make a difference in the next 3 months.
Right. And do you think it could be coming within the next 3 months?
Oh, I think it could be coming faster.
Yeah.
If it's going to come at all, it's going to come very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And this would allow you to give a test at an airport or anywhere on the spot where you suspect someone, instead of putting them in isolation for, 10 days, checking their fever, which does not diagnose anything.
Well, from the point of view of the rich countries, it has a few advantages. One, it makes the airport screening process make a heck of a lot more sense. I would do the screening at the country of origin. After you've gone through security and immigration and you're in the waiting area to get on the plane, then you run the test right there. And nobody gets on who tests positive. Everybody who tests negative gets a certificate that says so, that's internationally recognized. I think the other issue for the rich world is, as in the case of Thomas Eric Duncan, you know, all those health workers and now even going out to police officers and so on who had any contact with he, his family, their apartment and so on, have had to go through all the angst and anxiety of waiting for 21 days to find out, do I or don't I start presenting with symptoms, and having all their family and friends and coworkers freak out. If you could just simply tell right away, yes, no, yes, no, then you greatly decrease that anxiety factor and you don't spend millions of dollars trying to track down contacts you don't need to track.
So you're not saying this is something we would bring to Africa and
quickly diagnose
over
there? No, now that's where it really would make the difference. Yeah. Because right now in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, you have no idea who's infected until they're absolutely symptomatic and being dragged into a hospital. And there aren't enough hospitals. There isn't a method at the local level in villages, in neighborhoods within the cities to do surveillance that's really meaningful. But if you had a way for people to have a quick test, find out yes or no I'm infected, and be separated from those who have the opposite status, you cut the transmission.
So we hopefully we'll see that within 3 months coming.
I think sooner.
Sooner than that?
Yes.
Do you know?
I think some things are moving swiftly. The question is just going to be tests that are now underway. Mm-hmm. Do they show the right acceptable level of false positives and false negatives?
I know you're too good a reporter to give away anything. not ready to be given away yet. Have a drink of water. It's okay. Are you optimistic that there's money, that anybody... There was a meeting of the affected countries recently, right? Just a couple of days ago.
Yes.
What came out of that? Anything...
Nothing new.
Nothing new?
No new money.
No new money.
But a commitment from our government to take care of another problem that is really holding the whole effort back, and that is Medevac. It's very hard to get healthcare workers to commit to go to a foreign country in a situation where they could get a virus that kills 70% of its victims and say, oh, and by the way, there'll be nowhere way for you to get home if you get sick. Mm. You're stuck there. Either you're stuck there because politicians have passed a law that says you're not allowed to come home, or you're stuck there because there's no commercial airlines that's going to take an infected person. Mm-hmm. So it has to be a special Medevac transport. And I've been personally looking for it. There's almost no Medevac insurance left. They just won't cover it.
Oh. Well, when you were on the program a few weeks ago, you were talking about what a disarray the international community is. Has it firmed up anymore since then?
A little bit, but not enough.
Not enough.
The number one thing I'm hearing from folks on the ground is that they just don't know who's in charge of any given thing. And there was one excellent story in the New York Times recently about an entire shipment of medical supplies that had been sitting for a month on a dock in Sierra Leone. Well, actually, you can multiply that several times over. A lot of supplies are stuck in Senegal, stuck in Ghana, stuck in these countries' docks.
Well, what makes you think then if you come up with a rapid diagnostic test the next 3 months or sooner, it's not going to be sitting on a dock someplace, not getting to the people it needs to get to?
This is why you need a chain of command. You need somebody in charge. You need the power to push buttons, make things change. And all of that is still, shall we politely say, emerging.
Well, let's not be polite. Let's talk about what the real problem. What do you mean? Who is not in charge? Who should be in charge?
You know, we've never really faced a situation like this before, so we didn't have a pre-existing set of global understandings. Who's in charge? So the governments are in charge, right? Liberia, mm-hmm. Sierra Leone, Guinea, very, very weak governments with poor infrastructures. But the United States military is in charge of its operations. The British military in charge of its operations. The United Nations set up UNMEER, the United Nations Medical Ebola Emergency Response Command Post, and that's in Ghana, and they're in charge, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the World Bank thinks it's in charge of a fair component. Honestly, it's a moving target. It's constantly changing. And the watchword that all the politically correct folks in the picture like to use is coordinated rather than in charge. And to me, it's like saying a committee will take care of an epidemic.
It's like landing on D-Day with no one in charge.
Imagine D-Day without Ike.
Right. And there's no unified command anywhere. People just doing their own little things.
Well, it's not quite that bad, but close. And, you know, you hear of NGOs getting in and trying to do the right thing and setting up a clinic or a hospital somewhere. And then it comes to the question, one in particular, for example, only has had a handful of patients come in, mm-hmm. whereas MSF clinics, they've got people lined up on the sidewalk waiting to get in, and they literally can't get in until someone dies inside, mm-hmm. and then they'll pull another person off the sidewalk. well, what's going on? What's the difference between these NGOs? Why is one clinic being avoided by the masses and another is so full? It's horrible. It's hideous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these kinds of things are not getting straightened out.
Is it waiting for someone with an iron hand to come in and say, I'm in charge? Or is that politically incorrect? Is it not possible to have someone to do that?
Look, think about it this way. When's the last time there was an epidemic that had this kill ratio, mm-hmm. where three different presidents had to agree day to day on every policy choice?
So it's not like AIDS breaking out back in the 80s.
Like, well, it is like HIV in a number of ways. And the CDC director, Tom Frieden, recently said in his speech at the World Bank yesterday, that it did remind him of 1981, 82, 83 with HIV. And I see the comparison. I've been making it myself. And here's the reasons. First of all, stigma. Just as HIV got tied up with the stigma against homosexuals and against Haitians in the early days, here we have stigma against West Africans. And it's broadly painted as if, you know, a Nigerian is at equal risk with a Cote d'Ivoirean who's in equal risk with a Liberian, and that we should just keep all Africans out or stop all of Africa or build a wall around a continent sort of approach. And, you know, it starts to be the kind of situation that could mean that everybody with black skin is getting pulled aside at airports and having special tests done to them. And all of this could have really terrible ramifications, much as we faced, you know, you and I go back to the days at NPR when Ryan White's house was burned down for the crime of being a hemophiliac who had had a contaminated blood transfusion, and he was, I think, 7 years old.
Yeah.
It's that kind of possibility. I think the other thing that resonates in comparing the early days of HIV and Ebola is, you know, we didn't really understand HIV. We didn't have a cure. We didn't have a treatment. We didn't have a vaccine. We didn't have a test.
Yeah.
Welcome to the same world.
Laurie Garrett, author of The Heard the Sirens Scream, How Americans Responded to the 9/11 and Anthrax Attacks. Thank you for joining us today. Good to always see you.